Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Здравствуйте, and welcome to the History of Russia. This is episode 23, The Black Death. Thanks for listening in. So in the last episode, we did a mini State of the Nation, which looked at what life was like for Rus society during the early years of the Mongol occupation. And in summary, it was good, okay, for the Khans and the Orthodox Church, and not so good or terrible for the princes and the poor. And then we blitzed through the latter part of the 13th century and the early bit of the 14th and witnessed the decline of Vladimir, the rise of Moscow, and finished off by observing the reign of Ivan I Kalita, or Moneybag, which brought us up to the year 1340. This week we'll be bringing the pace back down and looking at the reign of Ivan's son Simeon, which started in 1340 and came to rather a tragic end in 1353. And maybe you've joined the dots, but if you haven't, the clue is in the title. But before we meet Simeon, there's just a general point that I want to make. I don't know why I haven't mentioned this before, and maybe it was glaringly obvious, but just in case it wasn't, right from the earliest times, from the 860s all the way through to where we are today, the same dynasty, the Rurikid, has ruled over the Vikings, Varangians, Rus. Taking its name from the semi-legendary-ish Rurik, the dynasty has somehow managed to walk through history's tightrope from its beginnings in Novgorod through its golden years in Kiev and ended up still going strong in Moscow by way of Vladimir. Now, I don't know how long the average ruling dynasty lasts, and there are some, like the Zhou in China and the Yamato in Japan, that have lasted a lot longer. But the Rurikids have been passing the baton through the generations, sometimes smoothly, most of the time not so smoothly, for 478 years so far. Now, obviously, the rules around what constitutes a change in dynasty, or what doesn't, can be pretty tenuous or arbitrary. But 478 years is no mean feat, and so before we go any further, I think that a round or a ripple of applause is in order for the Rurikids. Okay, anyway, with that out of the way, let's crack on with some history of Russia. So, it's 1340. Ivan I is dead. Step forward Simeon Ivanovich into the glare of Rus grand princeliness. So Simeon was Ivan's eldest son, and he's known to us today as Simeon the Proud. Although during my initial read-through of his exploits, I didn't pick up on any specific reason as to why that was the case, and so we'll have to see if anything is hidden in the detail. Maybe it will come out in the wash. What will certainly come out in the wash is that during his life he had three key adversaries. The first, who we know all about, was the Republic of Novgorod. But Simeon was able to deal with that fairly minor situation without too much trouble. The second was Lithuania, who we know next to nothing about. Now, I haven't mentioned the Lithuanians very much so far, but whilst I've been concentrating on the Mongols, Vladimir, Novgorod, and now Moscow, They've been busy, and Simeon is going to have his work cut out, keeping them mostly under control. And then his third enemy, which originated out in the east on the Mongolian steppe, and was the pandemic known throughout history as the Black Death or the bubonic plague. And for that, Moscow, like pretty much every other place in Europe and Asia that the plague touched, would have no answer. So let's take those three combatants in order, starting with Simeon's early years and Moscow versus Novgorod. So Simeon was in Nizhny Novgorod when he received the news of his father's death, and he realised that the first thing he would need to do was get over to Sarai and sort out the paperwork that would officially recognise him as Ivan's heir, not only in Moscow, which was more or less a shoo-in, but also as Grand Prince of the Rus lands, with the same tax-collecting responsibilities that had been enjoyed by his father. Just as a point of clarity here, going forward, I'll be referring to Nizhny Novgorod as Nizhny Novgorod and Veliky Novgorod, or the Republic of Novgorod, just as Novgorod, or the Republic. There, I hope that's clear. Anyway, it was securing the title position of Grand Prince that was the potential problem, and that was for two reasons. The first one was, even though Ivan had secured the agreement of the Golden Horde, they had in the past proved to be fickle and untrustworthy when it came to adhering to agreements that had been made in the past. And then secondly, there were now three roosters in this particular henhouse, as Moscow's new rivals, Constantine of Tver and Constantine of Suzdal, were also en route to the Khan, hoping at the very least to obtain a degree of independence from Moscow, and at most, complete control over their own lands. But there was no need to have worried. The Khan decided that the previous agreement made with Ivan was to be recognised in full, and possibly his mind was swayed by the bribe that Simeon paid. Anyhow, the two Constantines were forced to accept that Moscow and its heirs were still going to be preeminent amongst the Rus. And interestingly, Simeon also gained a claim on his succession from another source, the Byzantine Empire. Ah, the Byzantines. Yes, they're still around, although they're far less significant than they were. And in fact, in less than 100 years, the empire will have ceased to exist. Anyway, Constantinople granted him the ceremonial title of Epitrapezes Officios. That roughly translates as seneschal or steward. And whilst being praiseworthy and commendable, it sounds just a little bit patronising, suggesting that the Rus somehow held their territory on behalf of the empire. So, later in 1340, trouble kicked off in Novgorod, when Moscow's tax collectors arrived in the Novgorodian town of Torzhok. The local boyars locked the taxmen up, and then realising that perhaps this wasn't the best moves, called for help from Novgorod itself. When they heard about this turn of events, Simeon and the metropolitan Theognostus reluctantly but hastily organised a coalition of princes against Novgorod, claiming that, I'm going to do my quotation voice now, they, the Novgorodians, make war and peace with whomever they please, consulting no one. Novgorod regards not all Russia, and will not obey her Grand Prince. And two things here. Based on what we know about Novgorod, you have to admit that they had a point. And then the use of Russia again, rather than Rus. We find that creeping in more and more as we go forward. Anyway, as this coalition approached the Republic, the citizens of Torzhok, realising the way the wind was blowing, revolted against their boyars and sided with the Muscovite troops. Novgorod, also understanding how things were likely to pan out, and having problems of its own, and more of those in just a sec, decided to accept the likelihood of defeat by the coalition forces, and therefore agreed to cede all taxes from the Torzhok area to Simeon, who in return agreed to honour the town's existing civic charter. Okay, so what were Novgorod's problems. Well, they were twofold. The main issue was the constant raids on the Republic's territory that were being carried out by the Swedes and, more importantly, Lithuanians, who were becoming the growing power in the Baltic region. And then more indirectly, and probably caused by the external threats I've just mentioned, the Republic had started to be affected by internal political infighting, which, whilst not terminal, had started to weaken its ability to resist the pressure from its western neighbours. And of course, it stands to reason that if Novgorod had a problem, then Simeon by default had a problem, because if he wanted overall responsibility over the Rus lands, then that surely meant that he had to step in if the most important Rus principality outside of Moscow was under threat, unlike some of his predecessors had with the southern and western provinces. But before we get to what happened, let's just break away from the main narrative, because I think it's worth looking at why and how Lithuania was becoming a key force in the region. And spoiler alert, Lithuania isn't going to go anywhere soon. So first mentioned in the 10th century, Lithuania, or the area that makes up modern-day Lithuania, slowly developed from a territory that was raided by Danish Vikings into a territory that was paying tribute to Kievan Rus at around the time of Yaroslav the Wise in the mid-11th century, and which then turned the tables and started to raid and pillage along the western fringes of the Russiskaya Zemlya during the 12th century. By the mid-13th century, the disparate Lithuanian tribes had united, but they then underwent a period of effectively fighting for their survival against the Teutonic Knights and the Livonian Order. And this went on for around 100 years before eventually the Lithuanians sort of came out on top and could once more turn their attention to the lands to their east.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So in the late 13th and early 14th century, and with their territory secured and now rebadged as a Grand Duchy, and with Novgorod, Vladimir, and then Moscow striving for supremacy of the Rus and making sure that the Golden Horde was kept happy, the Lithuanians once again turned their attention towards their eastern neighbour and began to make inroads into the Rus provinces of Polotsk, Volyn, and Kiev. Okay, so that's a bit of background on Lithuania. Let's get back to the main narrative. So we're in the 1340s, and Lithuania and Sweden are flexing their joint muscles in Novgorodian territory, which flexing their joint muscles bit sounds a bit weirder than I meant it to be, so sorry about that. So what should have happened, or what you might have expected, is that Simeon would have formed another coalition, marched into Novgorod, and pushed the invaders back. But that's not what took place, because he had decided to play a different game, one that, if it worked, would benefit Moscow in the long term. And to put this strategy into effect, the Grand Prince took what on the surface appeared to be two completely unrelated actions. So he played for time as long as he could, and then in 1347 he dispatched his brothers, Ivan and Constantine, into Novgorod with orders to do just enough to make the Republic think that Moscow was on its side and keeping the Lithuanians busy and occupied. In other words, Moscow was fighting for a draw or a tie. Meanwhile, he took every opportunity that he could to drip-feed the Mongols with negative propaganda about the Lithuanians, slowly building a picture in the Khan's mind that they were the real threat to the Golden Horde, whilst also explaining that he was doing everything that he could to keep them at bay. So Simeon's aims then appear to have been threefold. One, the Lithuanians defeat Novgorod, leading to its collapse. Two, the Mongols defeat the Lithuanians. C, the Mongols hand Novgorod over to Moscow, who've done very little of fighting themselves, and get to take over Novgorod's lucrative trading empire. So what could go wrong? Well, the Lithuanians carried out their part of the plan, not that they knew anything about it, far too efficiently. And by 1351, were on the borders of Smolensk, not far from Moscow's own territory. But with the Mongols nowhere to be seen, Simeon was forced to get involved. So he did as little actual fighting as possible, preferring to get the Lithuanians involved in protracted negotiations, which would hopefully allow time for the Mongols to sweep in and save the day. But before that could happen, the Lithuanians, no doubt weary after years of campaigning, and with other territorial expansion in the southern and western Ruslands to concentrate on, decided to agree to Simeon's terms, allowing him to secure the disputed areas around Smolensk. Okay, so whilst all of this had been going on and a kind of stalemate had been reached between Lithuania and Moscow, a disastrous pandemic had spread throughout most of Eurasia, but not the Ruslands, or at least not yet. This pandemic, called the Black Death, originated somewhere in eastern Eurasia, we're not quite sure where, and is generally considered to have been caused by a bacterium, so it's not a virus, called Yersinia pestis. So Yersinia pestis infected fleas that then fed upon the blood of rodents, initially marmots and then rats, and in turn it infected them. Having then killed the rodent, the flea would look for another host, and as the pandemic took hold, this started to include humans. Now, Yersinia pestis has always been around, and in fact has been the cause of at least two other major outbreaks or plague, one in 6th century in Byzantine Empire, called the Plague of Justinian, and another in the early 20th, and in fact, the bacterium is still present today. But no one really knows what caused it to proliferate and have such a massive impact upon the human population in the mid-1300s, although global warming, insanitary conditions, and a growing urban population have all been mooted. The first recorded cases were reported from the Crimea in 1347, and from there the disease was spread westwards into southern Europe and North Africa by Genoese trading vessels, which unknowingly were carrying diseased rats. And people, I guess. From Italy, in 1348 and 1349, the plague moved through the rest of Western Europe, including France, Spain and England, and then started to spread back eastwards and northwards through Northern Europe, taking in Germany, Poland, Scandinavia and the Baltic states. So if you were unlucky enough to catch the plague, what happened? Well, that would depend on how it had been transmitted, as there were three different subtypes or streams of the disease: bubonic, pneumonic, and septicemic. And neither of them were good news. Bubonic plague, thought to be spread via flea bites, caused swellings known as buboes, hence bubonic plague, to appear in the neck, groin and armpits of its victims, followed by acute fever and the vomiting of blood. This strain of the plague is thought to have had a mortality rate of around about 80%, and usually death came within 8 days. It gets worse. The far less common pneumonic plague impacted the lungs and killed pretty much everyone who caught it within 7 days, and the extremely rare septicemic did the same, but quicker, and caused death in 100% of those who were unlucky enough to become afflicted. And the sheer number of deaths simply begs belief. And nobody really knows the exact figure, as population censuses were not kept at the time, but it's thought, and this is absolutely staggering, that between 75 million and 200 million died in Eurasia, which represents, we think, approximately 33 to 50% of the population. And if we put that into some kind of perspective, COVID has resulted in approximately 5 million deaths worldwide from a very much higher population. And the societal and human impacts of this pandemic were unimaginable and are best summed up by an Italian chronicler, Agnolo di Tura, who recorded his experience from Siena, where the plague arrived in May 1348. And I think this time, because this is quite serious stuff, I'm not going to muck around and do my voice. I'll just read it as it is. Father abandoned child, wives husbands, one brother another, for this illness seemed to strike through the breath and sight. And so they died, and none could be found to bury the dead for money or friendship. Members of a household brought their dead to a ditch as best they could, without priest, without divine offices. Great pits were dug and piled deep with a multitude of dead, and they died by the hundreds, both day and night. And as soon as these ditches were filled, more were dug, and I, Agnolo di Tura, buried my 5 children with my own hands. And there were also those who were so sparsely covered with earth that the dogs dragged them forth and devoured many bodies throughout the city. There was no one who wept for any death, for all awaited death, and so many died that all believed it was the end of the world. And there were other impacts. With less people around to do work, wages rose, and established feudal systems started to break down. And then, of course, and at a time when science or medicine could provide neither reasons for or solutions to the suffering, people reasoned that the plague was some kind of divine punishment, or, on a more sinister level, they looked around for someone to blame. And the blame, of course, fell upon those who were different or who were outside of the mainstream or who were at least able to protect themselves. The Jews, the Romani, foreigners, beggars, pilgrims and lepers. And this blame manifested itself in the form of violent attacks, rioting and murder. So that was the Black Death. And in 1352, it was heading towards the Rus. It hit Pskov at the beginning of the year, Novgorod in August, and by the spring of 1353 had reached Moscow. And this time, no cunning game playing or strategizing could save the Grand Prince, or his 2 remaining sons, or one of his brothers, or the Metropolitan. They all died. One last observation that perhaps comes across as insignificant after all of this mayhem, and perhaps is an indicator of how my brain works, is that I still can't work out why Simeon was called the Proud. Anyway, after what was quite a somber episode, we'll hit the stop button there. When we hit play again, we'll be covering the life and times of Dmitri Donskoy, Simeon's nephew. And in this post-pandemic world, we'll start to see the first chinks or cracks appearing in the Mongol occupation. We'll also see the expansion of the Muscovite state, but, and isn't there always a downside, further trouble, some of it serious, with Lithuania. Okay, so until then, stay safe, look after yourselves, and I'll see you all soon.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.